As a drummer, it's really intense.
Yeah.
And there are service elevators that we've had to use, that I've had to use for gigs in the city. And the elevators are big enough for barely two people standing up, and you've got to put your gear in there and get in and get out. It's really an intense exercise.
You have to be committed. Like, if you're going to be an instrumentalist professionally in New York City,
it's hard.
Yeah, you can't just do it for fun, you know? You're like, oh, I'm just going to do this one weekend. No. Not the wrong place.
No, it's an intense experience. So, in any case, that's not good for your health, Dave. What are you smoking there?
Cannabis.
Cannabis, okay.
Not cigarettes. No.
You're getting ready for our interview.
Oh, listen, please. You know, it's so great. It's interesting because I've had an opportunity of interest, like interviewing different types of people. When you interview artists, it's a whole different experience. I feel because you're going to teach me things in this interview that I probably never knew of before, you know, and touch on things that you don't always think about. You don't always wonder to yourself, that did happen to me. Why did that happen to me? What did I learn from that? You know, like, you have a career that spans many, many decades, and there's so much to learn. There's so many fuck ups, right, that happens along the road. But it's where we are now, I feel like, is the most important, like with everything that we have from the past.
Okay, I'll try to share some wisdom with you.
Let's make it interesting. I'm curious because, you know, the industry has changed so much in like past 10 years, 20 years. What was it like when you were starting up?
Well, I grew up in New York City, and I had an opportunity as a kid to check out some of the greatest jazz musicians alive at the time. From Count Basie and his big band to Elvin Jones to Philly Joe Jones to Buddy Rich to Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and on and on and on. And the opportunity to see that level of talent, that level of musical genius on a regular basis, established a certain baseline of what performance looked like at the highest level. And that established a certain threshold in terms of skill, musicianship, technique, professionalism. You had a chance to see the greatest of the great right in front of you, and they were constantly on display. You could get close to the energy of the performer. You could watch the way they managed a show, the way they worked a room, the way they managed a band.
Everybody learned from each other.
There it was. I mean, there was your laboratory. And so when you had a chance to see these types of musical geniuses up front, consistently, regularly, you knew what the industry was about. You knew what it took to succeed or not succeed as a professional jazz musician in New York City. It helped you understand what the game was.
Like a real playing, you know, ball playing perspective where you can see clearly what steps you would need to take. Right? Am I coming off the right place? Yeah.
Absolutely. As opposed to what I see all too often today, and that is a level of fantasy, a level of self-delusion in some regard, that it is a completely unreal perspective that many younger musicians, and I would go even outside of just the musical field, I would just say in life in general, the people, for example, if you looked at somebody like a Buddy Rich, or you are a Count Basie, or an Art Blakey, or an Elvin Jones, these musicians poured their being into the passion of their music, their performance, the level of their performance, and it established a certain benchmark that was incredibly high, incredibly intense, and it was incredibly consistent. There were no bad nights. You know, there was brilliant and there was near brilliant, but there was never anything else. And when you saw that as a musician, you realize that that was what the jazz industry, that's what these performers stood for. And if you were going to play this music, that's what you had to shoot for also. That comparator, yeah, I think, is not quite clear to younger people, younger musicians today.
No, and you bring up a really excellent point, because I remember when I was living in California, I was working for my brother's company. He had one of his workers. He was a technician, brilliant man, and he loved jazz. And I just loved the way he spoke about jazz. And he was maybe 5-6 years older than me. I'm 24. He was probably about 27, 28. And it's something you have to get into physically. Isn't that the whole beauty about instrumental art? You know, seeing instruments being played, hearing them, how they sound, and what you can do with them. It doesn't happen on a TikTok video for 1 minute. It happens in real life when those moments happen, right?
And I'll tell you that as a drummer, you have to also keep yourself in good enough physical condition that you've got the strength and the stamina and the practice and the dexterity to be able to manage playing the instrument. And as a band leader, not only do you have to perform, but you have to speak to the audience. You have to communicate about the history of the music. You have to interface with the audience. There's promotion involved. We did a recent show for NPR affiliate WICN in Worcester, outside of Boston.
Nice.
And we had radio promotion, and I did podcasts, and I was on radio shows, and on and on and on. And this is also part of the commitment that the musician makes, so that there's got to be education, there's got to be promotion, there's marketing, there's, of course, the music component, which has to do with putting together charts and putting together tune lists, and then coordinating with your bandmates. And sometimes there are rehearsals, but often there are no rehearsals. You just show up and you have a sound check and you play. You have to deal with the environment. You have to deal with the equipment. It goes on and on and on. So these are all of the components and many others. And that has nothing to do with practicing your instrument and keeping right, your chops up and being able to be prepared. I have a comment in my head, Dave, that my instructor taught me years ago, John Riley, the great John Riley. And he said to me, Josh, he said, when you're playing, when you're performing, he said, think about what you have to think about to be ready when you get to a point in the song to do what you have to do. Think about what you have to think about to be ready when you get there. So when you are performing and there are things happening in a song and there's happening within a set of music, even while you're performing and you are in that moment of improvisation, you've got to be thinking about what you have to think about to be ready for the next thing, because it happens very fast. It's constantly moving. And so the number of layers or levels that the musician needs to be operating on concurrently, it's complex stuff.
Yeah, it is. And it's so strange, because when you listen to a song, you know, when you hear a jazz progression, and you hear the horns blare, it's wild. The feelings and the emotions that you get when you're playing that instrument, like just being in that environment with your buddies, you know, your friends, and you're just creating something that is special. I can totally see that. You have to like think clearly and vividly of what you're doing to not only grasp, but to be a part of that, you know?
Well, if I can expand on that a little bit, I don't know how many of your listeners are musicians or jazz musicians or like jazz.
All kinds of people.
Okay, this is so we're going to talk a little bit musically at this point.
Oh, yeah.
But as a musician, there's a number of things going through the musician's consciousness during a performance. Number one, you have to know, as a jazz musician, you have to have some sense of the form of the song. Every song has a form, and you have to, it's the roadmap. You have to know what, obviously, what the melody is, but you also have to know the form.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you're listening to your bandmates, and there's certain ebb and flow of energy that has to do with solo and sections of the song and so forth. And so as a drummer, you're working on building and or reducing the intensity of the song based upon what's going on with your musical colleagues right around you. Then there are decisions that you may have in your mind about what you intend to try to do during the song. So for example, there are certain, as a drummer, grooves, or there may be certain musical motifs or certain solo ideas that you are going to go for if you feel it in the song. And so these are things that you may have premeditated in your mind, and you may or may not go for them based upon how you feel and the whole vibe of the improvisation. And then the next piece is just improvisation itself, which is whatever just comes out based upon your years of training and musicianship, and it either shows up or it doesn't show up, and you go with it. And that part of the journey is sort of unexpected. And sometimes it's great, and sometimes it doesn't work, and you keep going.
You never know, though.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. But when you're in it, you don't know where it's going, though. Right? That is the truth. But once you finally – I feel that way so many times with music. It's where you open up the first door in the hallway, you walk down the hallway, and you open up the last door. You don't know what's going on either side until you reach that end.
That is a good analogy. But I would say that as you gain more and more experience with a group of musicians you play with regularly, everybody gets to know the strengths and the weaknesses of the other musicians, and you tend to play in a way that enhances everybody's talents, and you know what they are, and everybody sort of works together. That's what makes a band a band.
Yeah. It's like the ultimate collaboration of people.
You can play with musicians, but if you don't know the assets of the other musicians.
We're all about the artist. That is the whole purpose of this podcast, period. And you have a really valuable tool. You can share this with artists, people that are creative, someone that can enjoy this podcast and really enjoy the experience of Lost in the Groove. So with that, let's jump back to today's episode, shall we?
It doesn't necessarily work very, very well, but if the musicians know each other and they've played together and they're all really talented people, good things really happen.
It's interesting, though, because there's a flip side to it. You know, take characters such as Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison was a horrible person to work with in regards to his bandmates. I'm not making this up. They were interviewed and they said it themselves. So, but strangely enough, they made really good music. It's kind of odd. You know, you think to yourself, don't you need everybody to work together to make great music? But
well, I'll tell you, my perspective is maybe a little bit different than that, to each his own. But I would rather play with a very good musician, not an amazing musician who's a terrific person, as opposed to an amazing musician who's an asshole. So I would rather play with a very good musician who's a terrific person, where we have a great relationship, any day of the week, over somebody who's like just off the Richter scale with talent, but a real schmuck. I'm not interested in that.
You stay away from certain kinds.
Because for good reason. Not fun. It's just not as much fun. Listen, here's the thing. I don't want the stress. I don't want the aggravation. I would rather have a good time, and I want the experience of making, whether it's going to be a performance successful or recording successful, I want these experiences to be really enjoyable. And what makes them enjoyable is working with terrific people. And if the person's a talented musician, it's all good. If a person is an extremely difficult personality but a great musician, it's just not as a rewarding. It's not a rewarding experience for me personally. That's just not my scene.
Yeah. It's just weird when you, I mean, for yourself, when you're living in New York, you get to bump into all sorts of kind of people. And I mean, I haven't met that many artists in my life comparatively. And it's weird when you meet a certain amount and you see how people are, you know, like you mentioned, where there are people that are super talented, but then there's also like they're super shitty and they're just a horrible human being. But then you can get someone that's a good person. They're pretty good in real life too. Like you get that equal balance. You know that because you've met people. You've interacted with so many people. You've seen how they performed and how they are as individuals when the lights go down.
Correct. And so, as a band leader, especially, you want to work with people that you can really hang with and that you respect and you can have a good relationship with. That's important. You know, I've had experiences working with musicians that haven't been pleasant, and you know, I don't go back to those relationships.
Do you feel a lot of times where I'm always curious about this, like the negative vibes where people can get very aggressive and angry, sometimes be addicted to certain things as an artist. You think it's like due to pressure or life? I feel like there's a lot of factors that go into it, but there's something that causes that.
I don't, think it would be appropriate to generalize, but I can say that typically, you know, people who are musicians are very sensitive people. And with a high degree of sensitivity come sometimes certain emotional challenges. Right. And, you know, some people deal with those sensitivities and those emotional challenges better. Some don't. And that, I think, is part of the experience of working with the musical personality. It's less common to find people who are artists who are also not only left brain and right brain oriented people. That's not that common. It occurs, but it's not that common.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just that there's a lot of things that goes into being an artist. You know, it's not just about being playing an instrument. It's also being sometimes the odd person out of the group. A lot of the times people gravitate towards playing drums, playing bass, because they don't necessarily fit in. They fit in elsewhere. That's their niche. That's their groove.
You know, people who are musicians or artists on any level, and you could take any art, dance, media, music, any form of music. People who have an artistic orientation, Dave, are people that perceive the world and have a relationship to their feelings and their inner experience from a perspective that's a little bit different than people who don't artistically view the world. And they feel the need to express the perceptions that they have, the feelings that they have. It's important to them. And what you get varies, obviously, from artist to artist. But the artistic individual has a point of view, whether it's emotional or perceptual, that's a little bit different. Typically, it's interesting. It's sort of like a new point from which to look at and examine things, which makes people say, "Huh, that's cool. That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have felt that." Right. And they want to share that, and hopefully, people gravitate to it. Sometimes just a few, sometimes many, but that's the artistic personality to some degree, I think.
Yeah. Wow. It's interesting to look at it, from that approach, you know, because I mean, when you spend the time learning an instrument, you know, spending your time figuring out the different chords, the different progressions, and the different things that you can do, and you know, like we've mentioned, on top of the fact that you know, being a part of a band, collaborating, and learning across from other kinds of people. But that takes effort. That takes something to put in, you know, and it starts somewhere.
Well, as a musician, as a jazz musician, I had the point of starting listening to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and Joe Morello and Blakey and Philly Joe and Joe Jones, and it just goes on and on and on. And so I had a chance to listen to the aspects of their playing that inspired me as a kid, and what I thought sounded great, I'd try to copy. I'd try to understand, how do they play that? How do they do that? What technique is required to be able to do the things they do? And inevitably, if the music inspires you as a musician, and these musicians inspire you in terms of what they can do, then the question is, what do you have to practice? What do you have to be able to do to emulate or copy what they do? And inevitably, you come to the conclusion that there's miles of distance between where you are and what these musicians were able to accomplish. And so now, if you're serious about it, you find teachers and you ask them, how do you get from here to there? And they give you the techniques, and then you have to practice them over and over and over again. And you're committed to trying slowly to get better, and you try to enhance your understanding.
The same thing over and over again.
And then you discover what you can't do, and then there's the next thing. I'll give you an example. So about it must have been about 10 years ago. There were a series of solos that I was listening to by the great Joe Morello, who played with Dave Brubeck. And Joe Morello was the drummer who recorded the famous Take Five. And Take Five is maybe the most famous jazz recording ever. And I listened to a series of solos and fills and so forth that Morello had played on a couple of recordings. And I went to my instructor and I said, John, let's break this down. And we transcribed the solos and we broke down a number of the techniques into bite-sized kind of essential pieces. And I started practicing it. And then, Dave, what I discovered is that I didn't have the technique necessary to be able to play the solo motifs that Morello was playing. So I had to take two steps backwards, even from just the transcript, to be able to start work on my chops, to be able to do the things that Morello did at a tempo of 250 beats per minute. I had to practice it at 100 beats per minute, and I had to practice it for a year or 2 years before I even began to get more and more dexterity. And over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 years, I started getting closer and closer in terms of my technique and my understanding to be able to actually begin to try to do what I heard 5 years ago in some of Morello's solos. How's that?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, one thing that comes to mind is, I always give this, the Beatles. You know, most people remember, like, the Beatles started off, their music was, okay, it was fun. But then something happened. They went to Hamburg, Germany. What did they do in Hamburg, Germany? They spent 8 hours practicing, just doing music, 8 hours every single day. And that sounds preposterous, like 8 hours every single day. Your finger must be killing, you know, your fingernails must be cut off and bleeding everywhere. But that's what they did. And you could see that in their music. You could see all of the work that goes into the music. So it's incredible when you hear this melodic piece and it's just so beautiful. And then when you actually break it down, you realize, whoa, this person had a certain technique or move or position that they reached that point because they practiced and they spent the time and yada yada, whatever the reason is, to get there. So there's like another level deeper in this already melodic, crazy, snazzy piece that you have in front of you. It's like, is there more?
Well, you know, what you're describing is, I think, embodied in a little anecdote about the great John Coltrane, the tenor saxophonist, the jazz tenor saxophonist. And Coltrane was in a recording session. And I mean, there was nobody that could play like Coltrane. And he was in the middle of a recording session, Dave. And in between takes, he would take his tenor saxophone, go into the bathroom, and practice. I want you to think about what I'm telling you. That on a recording session, in between takes, Coltrane would go to the bathroom and practice before the next take. Think about that.
Happy place?
It's a level of intensity in terms of what he needed to do to get what he felt in his heart and in his mind out through that instrument. That's how hard he worked.
Yeah, it's like a deeper level in a way of like almost meditation, where this reminds me, I do not remember his name, but there was an audio engineer or producer sometime in the 70s. He owned a record label. He had this thing where whenever he had music that was approached to him, he had a crappy radio that was specifically put into his car. He specifically asked for a cheap, crappy radio, and he would put the, you know, the 8-track or whatever into the piece, and he would listen to it, And if it sounded good in that system, then it was okay to print. Like, the and it, same example, like, you have this man that's doing a recording session. It's like, I'm going to start recording. I'm just going to do my practice in there. There's a reason why. And then when you know the reason why, you start asking yourself your questions. What are the benefits would you gain from being in that situation, doing it that way, trying it a different way?
Well, I think we're talking about people that have a love and a commitment to their art form that makes them geniuses. This is why they're as good as they are. It's not just magic that they get this good. They work their ass off and they never stop.
Yeah.
That's the point. And that's, to get back to one of your earlier questions, that's really the key, in my opinion, to becoming a good musician, an excellent professional musician, is you have to have a commitment to practice and evolve your technique and your ability. Peter Erskine, the great drummer and educator, talks about how your first obligation as a musician is to listen to music all the time for the rest of your life. If you're a musician, you have to always be listening to music. Always. That is your job as a musician. And whether I'm preparing for a show or I'm preparing for a recording project, I am always listening to music. I don't necessarily actively take everything I'm listening to apart, but when I hear things that inspire me or that I think sound good or that I think are pretty or that I think are ideas that I could do something with, I think, oh, that's cool. That's cool. And I'm always listening for something that's new, different, innovative, something that answers a question, something that enhances my own technique, something that helps me gain further insight. I'm always listening, even if it's not super active. I'm always listening.
Yeah. It's something that we kind of forget. You know, it's weird. But to be real, having an open conversation is not a legit thing these days. You know, the second you start opening up your mouth, I don't agree with that opinion. So what? Who cares? You know, if you put that type of mentality, can you imagine if you had that type of mentality on music?
Well, people have that mentality about music all the time.
Not in my circles. Okay.
I mean, seriously. I hate that. When I was a kid, I was very, very close-minded to many, many different forms of music outside of jazz. I was a snob. I liked jazz, and that's kind of what I like to listen to. And I didn't like, you mentioned the Beatles. I didn't care for the Beatles, and I didn't like the Jackson 5 or Michael Jackson stuff. I wasn't into it, I have to say. And as I got older, I realized that I had a closed mind and that these musicians were amazing and the music was amazing and there was so much to learn. And, you know, I will never tell you that Ringo Starr's solos were, you know, they stopped the show. They didn't. But I loved the grooves and I loved the music and I listened and I learned.
Yeah, there's a reason why I don't own any Ringos on vinyl. But I do own George Harrison. I do like George Harrison. I will have to say, had a really great solo career. And what I loved the most was over his span until unfortunately he passed away, his learning of different instruments and adding those to his different albums. So one thing you'll see in his career is like each album, you'll hear a different sound, something new, something interesting. And you're like, oh, and what George did was he spent his time learning about it, learning about the environment and what to add. And that is something that I can learn from an artist. you know, and take with me and maybe inspire me to do something with it. It's like we leave breadcrumbs for one another, whether we think about it or not. You know, same thing with music.
There really isn't a musician you can point to that you can't learn something from at this level. I mean, I heard an interview recently with Ringo, and he said, and as I said, you know, as a jazz drummer, I look at his chops, I look at his technique, and I think, you know, okay, fine. But I'm not going to be wowed by Ringo's soloing, his technique, but his grooves and his musicality are fabulous. And he says something in this interview, and he says, I always had to be ready at the drum kit because I never knew when we were going to start, and I never knew when I had to be on it immediately from the first note. And I was very impressed because he was always ready to immediately back up the band. And there was a very important lesson in that statement. And I learned a very important insight from Ringo with that one comment. So my point is that everybody at that level has something to teach. Everybody has something to teach.
You know, it's really important that you bring this up because George said this. Ringo was known, like, he was always on time, but there was once that he wasn't on time. He left in the middle of a meeting. And George said that when he left from the meeting, he knew the band was over. And it's funny, you have to ask yourself, like, Ringo was a drummer. You know, he wasn't like the main of the four, but he was the person that brought the band together. There's always that one person that brings everybody together. You always have that main person. It's not because, like, you're forcing everyone together. You know what everybody needs in a way, and everybody knows how to feed off of one another because of it. You're kind of like a composer, you know?
Well, I don't know whether the drummer is the composer most of the time.
I'm just giving that as an example in the case of the Beatles, but yeah.
But I would say this, that the drummer is foundational to any song, and the groove that the drummer lays down defines the genre of the song. If a drummer lays down a rock groove, it's a rock song. If it's a funk groove, it's a funk song. The drummer can't lay down a funk groove and turn it into a jazz tune, or play a jazz tune and have it be a rock song. Doesn't work that way. So whatever groove the drummer lays down, that defines the genre of the song, period. Period.
Yeah.
So the drummer has a very, very critical role to play. But again, when you
even have an opportunity, jazz, drums are really important in jazz, right? Like, it's when you get those deeper notes, those higher spikes in the song.
Well, for sure. But I would say that's true, you know, in many, many forms of music.
Right.
Not just jazz.
No, not just jazz, but that's just like one thing that just came to mind. Yeah.
But what I would say is that the role of the drummer is critical in terms of coalescing the sound of a band, clearly. So the point I guess we wanted to make here is that there is so much to learn with an open mind with regard to any great musician in any of the genres of music. And a jazz drummer can learn from a rock drummer, and a rock drummer can learn from a funk drummer, and on and on and on. If the musicianship is at a high level, everybody can learn from everybody. And yeah. that I think is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to lead off on this with you made your own business. You took something from your career and built something from it. Do you want to walk me through exactly what you did? And, you know, we, yeah.
I'm not sure I am clear on your question, Dave. Can you zero in on me?
The Verve.
Yes. The question is, how did I start the band?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've told this story many times, but in essence, I heard some really terrific young musicians back in the Danbury, Connecticut area.
Hey, it's Dave, and I quickly just wanted to jump in and say, if you've been enjoying the podcast, enjoying this episode, if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that'll be so greatly appreciated. Because here's the thing, someone might read that review and make the choice if they want to listen to the podcast. You get to help grow this podcast with us. How fucking cool is that? Let's jump back to today's episode.
In 2006, that I thought really were terrific jazz players. And I was a jazz musician from the time I was a kid in New York. And I had played with bands and I did a whole bunch of stuff as a sideman and participating in traveling big band and on and on. But I never had my own group, and I had no interest in it particularly. But I heard John Blank, who was a young tenor saxophonist from Westcon in Connecticut, performing in Danbury with Chris DeAngelis, a bassist, and some other players. And I thought he was terrific. And I introduced myself to John, and I said, "Hey, man, I love your saxophone playing, and I really think you're a terrific jazz player. Would you like to get together and play some music?" And he said, "Yeah, why not? Sure. You know, if you'll book it, I'll show up." And so I did. And to make a long story short, we started performing at country clubs and restaurants, and we started a following in the Connecticut area, and it became substantial. And we performed in large groups, consistently came out to hear our music. And this went on for years. We eventually recorded our first CD in 2012. It went to number 5 on the national charts. I was completely shocked. And I said to the radio promoter, Neil Sapper, who was handling our music out of California, I thanked him for this amazing experience. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "What do I mean? We recorded our CD. We had this amazing experience. I'm done. I'm going back to, you know, performing." And he said, "You can't do that, man." He said, you just have a number 5 a CD on the charts. You can't just disappear. You need to do another recording." I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Yes, you do." So I said, all right, one more. So we recorded another album and we released it a year later, and it also went top 10. And that's when I realized, I said, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe we really do have a following. And that was the beginning of the band sort of migrating from a performing group more to a recording group. And that was the beginning of a run of about 5 top 10 albums, including a number 1 album in 2018, Connect the Dots. And the Verve Jazz Ensemble started to develop a national and international following. And here we are, you know, 10 years later into our recording career and almost 20 years into the beginning of the band. And we have a big following nationally, internationally, and we've recorded and released 8 albums. And, you know, there it is. But it was not by design, Dave. It was not by design. It all sort of happened.
You said you were going to do one and you were done. You know, you were going to move on and finish.
That was it.
I mean, what has it turned into now for you? I mean, a lot of things have changed, especially when you started your career as a jazz musician to getting a part of this and to where you are now. I mean, how has it been for you? Like, especially like in the past few years?
Well, first of all, I love the music. I do this purely because of my love of the art form. You know, we don't do this to make money, obviously. there is not much money to be made in jazz. And if you can run a band that can pay its bills and record an album every year or so, or have the band booked and perform on even a semi-regular basis, that's pretty good. Because you've only got about 2% of the listening audience in the United States that listens to this art form, jazz. It's not a very popular musical form anymore. It used to be, but it isn't anymore in the United States. It's far more popular in many countries around the world, certain countries in Europe, Japan, and so forth. Yes, yes. But in the United States, many people will say, oh, I love jazz, but they don't really follow jazz. They don't really know the art form that well. They'll listen to it. It's interesting. It's intriguing, but they don't really know the players. They don't know the history. So, you know, we don't have a strong component, a large component of the listening audience in America that's focused on jazz anymore. So our job here at the VJE is to try to bring the palette of jazz to as many listeners as we can. And as I say all the time, Dave, our listeners are a broad array of those who are new to jazz and don't know anything about jazz, but are interested in listening because it sounds cool and they like it and they want to learn more, to people who have been listening to it for 50 years and think it's the greatest music in the world. And so we try to appeal to both ends of the spectrum, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do, but that's the kind of the objective that as the band leader at the VJE, Verve Jazz Ensemble, that's what we try to do, is make jazz accessible to a very wide listening audience, from novice jazz listeners to experienced, and find something exciting for both ends of the spectrum to get out of the music.
I feel that, first of all, I think that's really beautiful, and I think it's a really great way of just showing the history. There's so many genres, but there are so few genres that have such deep roots, especially in American culture. I mean, think of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, 60s, just the jazz scene. Look, like, I'm not a novice, or, you know, I listen to jazz. I don't know all the names of different people, but when you can interact and hear different tastes, like people that are now, right, that they're interested in funk and they want to do funk jazz, you know, or somebody is more interested in more of a pop, you know, pop jazz, or more hazy, you know, more mellow jazz. These are different things that people can try out, you know, people yes. can see and interact with. And I like jazz. I mean, it's sad that it's only 2%. You know, you wish that, like, more people would be into it, but
it is what it is, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons that only 2% of the listening audience listen to this music today. That's a whole other conversation. How did we get here? But if you go back to the 1930s, I'll pick up on some of your comments, you know, the pick up on the big band era, and you follow the era of the early big band era to the period of the big bands during World War II, and then to the bebop era, and then to cool jazz, hard bop, West Coast, Latin, Afro-Cuban, more electronic jazz. You get into the stuff like Weather Report, Brecker Brothers in the 70s.
Yeah.
You move into the 80s and so forth. Every decade, every generation of music evolved a sound, and they took the art form in a different direction. So you're interested in jazz. Who are some of the people that you like to listen to? How did you discover jazz initially? What were some of your influences as a jazz listener?
It's hard to say, like, some things that I don't have any specific people that I like to listen to. I have a certain playlist, And this comes from how I used to listen to jazz. I listened to a lot of like New Orleans 1930s jazz, 40s. That's primarily what I'm into. If I listen to vocal, it's going to be Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday is one example. The way that I fell into jazz was when I was a kid, we used to go to the library. People don't do this anymore. Surprise. But one of the librarians there was very into jazz. And I remember I was looking at a bunch of DVDs and CDs and stuff that they had laying around. And I started playing around and listening to this stuff when I was a kid. And whenever I have the opportunity to see like a jazz performance, whenever I'm out or something, I just like sit there. The reason is because a lot of the times when you don't physically see it, you don't realize that there's four or five instruments and they're like facing a corner. And then the clarinet blows and you see the drums, you know, changing its beat. And then you see the bass player changing to a different instrument. You're kind of watching everything move in motion all at once. But yeah, I should get more into jazz. I really want to, but.
Well, it's nice that you are interested in Ella Fitzgerald as an example. And if you just take Ella's career,
voice.
She's unbelievable. She was, you know, the voice described as the voice of God. And if you listen to all of the different organizations, musical organizations that Ella performed with, Dave, if you just follow her career from Chick Webb back in the 1930s all the way through her career, you will touch almost every component of every major jazz performer for, I don't know what, 50, 60 years. So if you just examine Ella Fitzgerald's career and you listen to all of the bands and all the different musical styles that she played with over the course of her career, it would open you up to 100 or more of the greatest jazz musicians of all time. Just that one exercise would change your entire perspective to jazz.
And like I was saying earlier, there was something about that period in New Orleans when it came to jazz. You could hear it. I mean, thankfully, there are recordings, and so many of them. It was a different time. It was like as if this is all they had to live for. That's it. It's all they're doing. They're doing jazz 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365. You know, like, that's it. That's all they have. Well, it's crazy.
Life was different, dude. They didn't have video games. There was no Snapchat. You know, you couldn't get lost on YouTube. It was a different world, man.
I mean, did that ever inspire you? You know, did you ever, like, what's your experience and like feelings towards that type of jazz?
I was not motivated by Second Line and New Orleans stuff, particularly. It never really, as a kid and as a younger musician, it did not really impact me. I listen to Second Line now, and I am really amazed at the groove, and I think it's very, very hip stuff. But when I was younger, it was over my head. I just didn't dig it. You can't dig everything, man. Everybody, you just can't dig everything.
I know. And you bring up such a great point. There are so many great eras of jazz. It's like, be honest, where do you start? If anybody asks, like, where do you start your jazz journey? There's so many places to begin.
Well, the answer to that question is you begin where you are the most interested. So when I was a kid, I listened to big bands, and I really enjoyed listening to the big bands. I found the music to be exciting. I could understand the components of the band. I played in the junior high school and high school bands, so I had a context to understand the structure, sax section, horn section, rhythm section, the way the songs were constructed. All of that made sense to me, and I got a lot out of it. Then I started learning the specific performance aptitudes of some of the greats, greatest pianists, greatest drummers, greatest horn players. And then I would spend time learning other great pianists and alto sax and tenor sax and trumpet and trombone and drums and bassists. And, you know, you just start mining different ore of the musical landscape. And, you know, you over the course of years or decades, you start to put the pieces together. So it doesn't matter where you start. It just matters that you start at a place that you enjoy. And if you like, for example, Weather Report, and you like funk, and you want to listen to, I mentioned before, you know, the Brecker Brothers is a place to start, or you know, you like Ella Fitzgerald, and you want to go back and listen to what she did and recorded the jazz. In all the performances that she did at jazz at was it the
Apollo
the Philharmonic, I forgot the JHP.
She performed at the Apollo though many times.
I can't tell you, you know,
I think
what her
so.
What,
I think
tons.
I mean,
tons. Well, she recorded back in the day with Chick Webb back in the, you know, the early to mid 1930s. But
yeah,
my point is that she recorded a ton in the 1950s with JATP, whatever that the acronym stands for. I'm spazzing on that right now. But my point is that it doesn't matter where you start. Start somewhere and go from there.
I think this is one of the biggest advantages that we have now is the amazing fact that because of the internet, we have so many ways of listening to all of this music than ever before. I mean, the options before the internet were very limited. You know, the ways that you'd be able to find all these interesting artists was you go to a music store and you ask the music dude, you know, the guy with dreads that was behind the cash register. But with the work that you're doing, and that is a perspective to keep in mind. How do you be able to give an opportunity to let everybody hear, just have everything in front of them, choose, figure out what you like. You know, like you said, you don't need to start somewhere, you need to begin. You got to find what you like and go from there.
Yeah. Don't overly complicate it. It is Jazz at the Philharmonic, JATP is the acronym. And Ella Fitzgerald performed for many years with the Jazz at the Philharmonic program. And just check out her music just with the JATP artists. It doesn't matter, Dave, where you start. You start based upon what you like to listen to, and you go from there. If you find, as an example, that you like vocalists, then listen to other vocalists. If you like small combos, listen to other trios. If you like big bands, then listen to other big bands. If you like trumpet players, go listen to other trumpet players.
Right.
Some you will like, some you won't. And then the ones you like, who did they play with? What were their recordings? Listen to some of those records. What other musicians did you hear from that era? And so forth. That's the way the whole thing opens up. That is the way Pandora's box gets popped open in jazz.
Wow.
You're right, man. I hope you're okay. I'm not.
No,
trying
I'm
to
good.
Give
it's
too much information. Yet.
You know, no, it's a lot to process. It, you know, like I said at the beginning of this, there's a lot of things that you learn as you do this. You know, one of the things is when you talk to people and you have an hour long conversation and you really break things up and you go to different places and you not only learn something, but you learn to have a different approach to it. You're like, okay, doesn't need to be that difficult. You know, it could be more of an easier state of mind, you know? It doesn't have to be left or right.
Dude, this is supposed to be fun. This is not supposed to, you don't have to have a master's degree to listen to jazz. And unfortunately, a lot of people think that jazz is too freaking complicated and they turn off. And my message is, no. Jazz is not intended to give you brain damage. You're supposed to listen to the music because you dig it, you enjoy it. And then if you find something you like, explore other components of it, whether it's vocalists or instrumentalists or eras or group sizes or whatever, that are in the neighborhood, and explore. You have to have a curiosity to expand your horizon a little bit at a time. Take little steps, but don't turn this into walking into a liquor store with 72,000 different kinds of red wine. You don't get there overnight.
My God. Yeah, and you know, you're right. You can overcomplicate other genres too. You can overcomplicate rock. You can overcomplicate heavy metal. You know, you can overcomplicate house. I don't know if you could do that. Sorry.
I don't know. But the idea here is my job as a jazz musician is to try to make jazz easy. That's my job. I got to try to make jazz easy. If I make jazz hard, I failed, because jazz should be fun. It should be something that is inspiring. It should be a form of music that, whether you're cleaning your garage listening to jazz, or you're hanging out with your friends and it's in the background, or you're sitting down to listen because it's really great music and you want to really focus on it, there's lots of different approaches to the music. And however you approach it, whatever purpose you might have, don't make it too difficult, please. I want to make it clear, this music is not supposed to give you brain damage.
No, and it's something I wanted to point out, which I wanted to say earlier, is especially for some people, when you're smoking cannabis, or people that do edibles, cannabis has a very interesting way when it comes to jazz, and I've noticed this. Like, it's, in many ways, it's a great way to relax, especially when you're having a session. It's a great stress reliever. And it just in general, with different types of music, the things, when you fall in love with something, it's not over complex. Just the way that it makes you feel, the way that it makes you feel less anxious, less stress, you know, you just get into it. I guess it's a feeling. Well, I don't know.
Well, that's the idea, man. If art, in my opinion, if art doesn't help you to feel more relieved, then it isn't doing its job. Now, there are going to be certain artists that are going to disagree with that, and they're going to feel that they want to create a sense of agitation, or they want to create some other effect in the receiver of the art form. That's fine. But from my point of view as a jazz musician, I believe that the experience of the music should be an uplifting, happy, positive, relaxing, relieving process. That to me is the objective, at least from my perspective, of what we intend as members of the Verve Jazz Ensemble.
Yeah. I think that's also something really so powerful, because like we've been talking for the past hour, and you're very passionate about the art form and passionate about jazz, and it shows a really great strength, especially when you're an instrumentalist and you have a career in music, where this is something that you've worked towards, you know, something that you've built towards. And more than that is, you got to be an artist. You know, I feel like that is the number one thing, especially for younger artists today, is like that opportunity.
I thank you for your kind words, and that's a nice compliment. I appreciate that. And you know, the path was simply one of following what I enjoyed listening to. I was inspired by other great musicians. I endeavored to try to understand what they accomplished to some degree. I put in enough time to practice enough to be able to attempt to emulate some of the music that they played. I attempted to share the insights with other listeners, and I did it because I loved it. And that's the key to all of this. I did it because I loved it. I continue to love it. I want to share it because I feel that it brings meaning and hopefully some good vibes to other people's lives. And as a musician, that's what I bring to the game. So if that is what turns it an interest into a career, so be it. But that's it. I mean, I don't actively teach. A lot of my colleagues do. I don't have time for that. But I share what I do enjoy in the art form verbally. I do podcasts. I do a lot of interviews. You know, this is, I guess, my shtick. This is the educational part of what I do. I talk.
Well, it's a good way of doing it, and it's a great way of broadening approach and awareness to jazz and maybe possibly getting some people that weren't interested in jazz, giving them a second thought. You know, let me try this out. Let's see how this goes. Question for you, for all these wonderful people, where can they find your work, the stuff that you're doing? I know you have a website.
We have all of those things. Well, if you'd like to follow the Verve Jazz Ensemble, go to followvje.com and join our email list, and we will keep you posted on our performances and recording projects and other cool things. Verve-jazz.com is our website, and we have all of our recordings and, of course, our performance calendar and videos and reviews and all kinds of stuff on the band and bios and interesting stuff that people can learn about the musicians and the music and the projects and all of our work. And of course, you can follow us on all of the major social media platforms and listen to us on Spotify and Apple Music and everywhere that you can find music. Anywhere.
Perfect. That's great. You got one great place to get everything and to check out all the different kinds of sides of jazz and learn something. You know, I did see on the website where there are articles, there's biography there, so you get to read and learn some things about instrumentalists and artists you didn't know before. If you want to find out the podcast, you could find us on Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Lost in the Groove Pod. So with that, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your work and your experience and career. Josh, it's been an absolute real pleasure. All right, guys, we'll see you on the next one. Bye, everybody. Ha! Da-da.